You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, 9 witnesses testified this week in the public impeachment hearings for President Trump. Coming up, we'll look at who said what, where the investigation stands today, and what happens next. First, more than 10 million people all did the same thing in one day last week. They subscribed to Disney Plus, the new TV and movie streaming service. The competitor for other services, including Netflix and HBO Now, offers a host of historic Disney movies, as well as some new original content.
Freeze!
No!
Drop your weapons!
No, pardon. Sorry, I didn't mean to alarm.
This is Dr. Pershing. Please excuse his lack of decorum. His enthusiasm outweighs his discretion. Please lower your blaster.
Have them lower theirs first.
We have you 4-1.
It's a scene from The Mandalorian, a Star Wars spin-off TV series that people can only watch on Disney+. Joan E. Solzman has been covering the launch of Disney+. She's a senior reporter on tech and media for CNET. Joan, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Well, how big a deal was this launch? Sounds like a big number of people signed on.
It was such a big launch that even though Disney had been planning the service for years, hyping it for months, they still didn't anticipate how many people would be the demand that would be coming in to sign up. And they had all these glitches on the first day, all these people complaining about not being able to log in or seeing titles drop out or streaming getting buffered. So it was bigger than even Disney anticipated.
There are a lot of streaming services out there. We'll talk about some of the competition in a bit. But what is Disney offering on Disney Plus that might lure people in?
Essentially, the idea is that Disney Plus will be the streaming home for everything that you can think of Disney. So that means Marvel, Star Wars, Pixar, Disney Studios stuff, whether it's live action or Frozen sort of things, animated, and also Nat Geo. The idea is that not immediately at launch, but eventually everything that you can think of in the Disney theatrical and video universe will be on Disney Plus, one place to go, one-stop shop.
And people may know that Disney owns properties like Star Wars, though, you know, the Disney label isn't usually associated with that historically. But also Disney's bought properties like, I think, Fox Entertainment. So The Simpsons run
right.
would be on Disney Plus.
Exactly. And The Simpsons is actually one of the most popular titles being streamed on Disney right now based on what the app shows is trending. Because of Disney's gigantic takeover of Fox, that unlocks not only things like The Simpsons, but these other things like edgier stuff like FX or movies, R-rated movies like Deadpool. The way that Disney's sort of dealing with the less than family friendly, R-rated, edgier content is that kind of stuff is going to live on Hulu, which is now majority owned and operated by Disney as well. That's going to be the home for the adult oriented stuff, and Disney Plus is where you find the PG-13 and softer family friendly things.
And that takes me to another point. I would have thought of Hulu as a competitor to a streaming service like Disney Plus, but given the convoluted nature of media ownership, they're actually at the same table.
Yeah, and you know, it's less convoluted than it used to be. It used to be that Hulu was owned by 4 media companies, and now it's narrowed down to just 1. The idea with Disney owning Hulu and Disney Plus, as well as ESPN Plus, is that they can create, they have created a discounted bundle where you can get all 3 of those at once.
Talking to Joan E. Solzman from CNET, looking at the launch of Disney+, one of the latest in the growing number of streaming services out there. Joan, for a while, it was just pretty much Netflix, right?
And Netflix is still by far the dominant force in video streaming. Netflix has more than, I think they're predicting to have more than 160 million members by the end of this year. You know, Disney, they made a gigantic splash by having those 10 million signups within little more than 24 hours. But, you know, 10 million is a far cry from 150, 160. So Netflix is definitely still the dominant player. Nothing's going to change that for a while, but it will. What will be interesting to see is how that subscriber growth starts to change as more direct competition enters the landscape.
Is it, I've seen some cases of this, is it a thing where, okay, Netflix used to have this property and that property, but now that other company wants to take their TV shows and go home and host their own service, is Netflix going to start losing the stuff that's been bringing people in?
Yes. Depends, though, exactly on what it is that brings you in. You know, Netflix has been anticipating that this was an eventuality, that eventually TV was going to be internet delivered and programmers like Disney and others would stop accepting all the millions of dollars that Netflix was giving them for their titles and keep them to themselves. And that's what really precipitated the entire Netflix original strategy, is that Netflix needed to be able to own its own content, be producing its own content, so it didn't have to be, you know, it didn't have to exist at the whims of other programmers. But it's significant. You know, Netflix entered into a deal with Disney, I think, 5 years ago, so that for the last 3 years, Netflix has been the one place that you go to stream all those blockbuster Disney movies. And some of those movies are still on Netflix today. It's going to be a big change. And it's hard to quantify exactly, you know, how many people come into Netflix specifically for those Disney properties. It's hard to understand how much of a threat that is to keeping customers now that those things are going away. But it's certainly a really high profile kind of content that's not going to be available for people anymore. It'll draw people to somebody else.
Another big name streamer is HBO. They've got HBO Go and Now and this and that. I don't know how it all fits together. But how big, how important is HBO in the streaming world?
I think that HBO is going to be launching HBO Max in May. And I think besides for Disney Plus, HBO Max is going to be the other streaming service to really watch as a competitive threat to Netflix. They're putting a lot of firepower behind HBO Max. They're going to be investing a lot in a pipeline of originals. And, you know, HBO has really great content and a wonderful brand halo like Disney did. You know, people associate HBO with really high quality content. What AT&T and Time Warner, the owners of HBO and HBO Max, are doing now is they're diversifying that content away from maybe what you traditionally think of HBO being sort of adult-oriented, edgy, you know, maybe a lot of nudity and some not-so-family-friendly language. Also, obviously, has kids stuff, but they're diversifying into things that you don't associate with HBO, like Friends is going to be there, The Big Bang Theory is going to be there, and I think that will be kind of confusing for consumers. Where do you go for these things that you don't associate with the HBO name?
Let's confuse people more, because Now we've got networks trying to make a go of their own streaming services. And, you know, hey, we've got a new Star Trek franchise, but you can only get it by streaming ours. How successful has that been for individual broadcast networks?
You know, it's hit or miss. It depends on, you know, not every streaming service is created equal, and not every fan base is created equal as a niche streaming service audience. So it really kind of depends on what the content proposition is, how well the tech actually works. Disney Plus was a good example of how it's not easy to get the tech right out of the gate if you don't have a background in having a streaming app. But what we have seen is that these services that are hinged on a linear network that people recognize, a lot of it depends on how all in the company is willing to go on that streaming option. Disney and soon HBO Max are examples where the companies are really investing heavily in shoring those up as the future of those networks. Other ones, you know, it's kind of an also ran afterthought if you want to sign up as an a la carte option. So what we've seen, yeah, is the companies that really dedicate a lot to these services are the ones that are most likely to bring people in.
Talking to CNET reporter Joan E. Solzman about the new TV and movie streaming service from Disney and where it fits into the world of streaming. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you one of the, 10 million people who gave Disney Plus a shot on the first day? Have you been watching it so far? Do you stream with Netflix or HBO or one of the networks? Are you scratching your head trying to figure out what to get? Oh, yeah, Amazon Prime. That's another one. Are you puzzled by how to sort this all out so you can watch the stuff you want to watch? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with CNET reporter Joan E. Solzman about the new TV and movie streaming service Disney Plus and where it fits into the wild world of content streaming. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you sign up for the new Disney service? Is it part of your menu of options for online streaming, or have you steered clear? Are you puzzled by what's out there? Are you going to wait to see how it all shakes out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Tyler is with us in Sparta. Tyler, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Tyler?
Yes, yeah, so I got Disney Plus through a Verizon subscription. Because they offered a free year subscription to Disney Plus, so I'm wondering how many of those 10 million subscribers came through that route.
Tyler, thanks for the call. I don't know if we have exact numbers, Joan, but is that part of the story here?
It's definitely part of the story. Disney did not disclose how many of those 10 million signups were through this very significant Verizon deal, where anybody who has a Verizon Unlimited plan gets comped a free year of Disney Plus. So we don't know. We don't know if that's the majority of signups. We don't know if it's some sort of minority, but you have to presume that it's a significant number. And we also have to remember that anybody that signed up on that first day, whether it was through Verizon or whether it was simply signing up without any sort of promotion, everybody gets access to at least a 7-day free trial. So all of those 10 million signups that happened in that first period, they were all free. So nobody at that point had ever had to consider, is this really worth paying for? But it's important to keep in mind that Disney's pricing Disney Plus at $7 a month if you pay the monthly rate. That's a significant discount to Netflix's most popular plan and even Netflix's cheapest tier. So it'll be interesting to see how many of those 10 million stick around, if they grow. We won't find that out until next year. Probably is going to be the next time if we get another number. But so far, we don't know if the Verizon promotion was the real driver of that demand.
So there could be people out there right now in the midst of a 168-hour binge session planning to cancel when that free trial is over. Potentially.
Yeah, and what we saw on it launched, Disney Plus launched on November 12th. That was a Tuesday. What we saw the following Tuesday was a huge spike in Google searches, Disney how to cancel Disney Plus or cancel Disney Plus. So clearly people wanted to know what they needed to do before getting charged. But it's really hard to extrapolate from those sort of overall aggregated trends how much of a 10 million signup pool of people decided they wanted to churn, which basically means opt out. We'll have to wait and see.
Tyler, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Richard with us in Madison. Richard, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm wondering how it's going to work with aggregators like Roku, for instance, where they provide service to any number of the different providers, and if Roku is going to kind of get in on one price fits all or one price, you know, fits a number of different providers or something like that.
Richard, thanks for the call. Yeah, Joan.
Yeah, that's a great point. So while there's this burgeoning competition to deliver streaming content to people, there's also this sort of underlying current of people competing to be the place that you go to figure out where the heck you're supposed to watch what you want to watch. Roku is a really good example of a company that wants to be that sort of one place to search. You can find where that title is. It'll do the work for you. Another company that's trying to position itself in that place is somebody that's kind of straddling both lines. It's Apple. Apple, a week and a half before Disney Plus launched, was Apple's big foray into original streaming content, Apple TV Plus. But Apple TV Plus doesn't have a library. It only has original content. And what Apple's strategy is, it wants its Apple TV app to be where you can not only watch its own streaming content, but also where you can rent things. You can get, if you have HBO as a streaming service, it'll feed into that too. And that way, Apple's TV app will become the default place you go to watch all of your streaming services. The complication there is that we have a bunch of different people trying to be the one place that helps you find everything. And it's not clear who, if there's going to be one dominant player yet that really serves that need.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Joan E. Solzman from CNET. Disney Plus kicked off last week, the new streaming service, joining many other streaming services. Still time for you to join in with what you have decided to do when it comes to streaming, what confusion you might still have. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Joan, when I was a kid, the question was, can I angle the antenna to pick up stations from Toledo, Ohio and Windsor, Ontario? Then it was, you know, basic or extended or super deluxe cable. Now it seems like there's so many decisions. Which streaming? How do I get it? Through Roku or my phone or my smart TV? Is there going to just be this point of consumer confusion overload?
I think what's happening right now, it's a pendulum swing. You know, with cable, that's the king of all bundles, right? You pay a high price, but you get more content all bundled together than you could possibly ever imagine or want. The thing that made that easy is that you only had one thing to turn on to find out what was out there for you to watch. But as we've seen these individual streaming services arise, this disaggregation has happened. And we're getting to the point where we're going to sort of reach that peak disaggregation where there's so many different services all sprinkled about with kind of confusing logic about where you find what. That what the next stage is going to be is a re-aggregation where you'll see companies like Apple try to be that centralized place where you can at least figure out where everything is. And if you want, you can stream it there. HBO Max, I think, is going to be trying to replicate that big bundle where you can get every single kind of streaming video that you want, be it live stuff or, you know, back seasons of a show. I think HBO Max is also going to go for that. So while people like to complain about their cable service, the ease of it is it was one place you go to. We're getting into the part where there's a million places it seems like you have to go to. I think we're going to start swinging back to that aggregation, everything bundling up together again soon.
Let's go back to our callers. Rick is with us in Holman. Rick, hi.
Well, good afternoon. My question is for us old buffers out here that don't have a internet TV, how am I supposed to stream anything?
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. A lot of people out there, Joan, in Rick's situation, they have an old-fashioned TV. It is not internet capable now.
Yeah, so anytime, most of these streaming services try to have wide device support. And so, for example, Netflix, most of their viewing is on large screen TVs. It's the biggest screen in the house. About 70% of Netflix's viewing is on a television. So if you want to stream content, you don't have to watch it on a TV. If you have a mobile phone with a mobile connection, you can stream there. You can always stream on a computer, on the web. But, you know, most people want to watch these really, you know, well-produced shows on the best screen they have, and that's a television. But if you don't have a smart TV, there are tons of devices. You know, we talked about Roku earlier in the program. Roku is a device that you can hook up to many TVs. It depends on how long ago you bought your TV, what kind of connections it has. But there are a lot of, they're called over-the-top streaming boxes. Roku's one. Google's Chromecast is another. Amazon Fire TV is another. There's a lot of makers that essentially can turn your not smart TV into a smart TV that can stream if you have a regular internet connection into your home.
Thanks for that call. Good luck. Alex joins us now in Madison. Alex, hi.
Yeah. Hi. So I was wondering about with all the streaming services that we have now with Netflix and now Disney Plus, how do you keep up with the forever changing options For example, a movie will get pulled down after a certain amount of time on Netflix. How do you keep up with all of this, all these changes?
Alex, that's a great question, Joan.
It's really hard because these deals are, they're decided years in advance. They're not opaque and, or I'm sorry, they're not transparent. They're very opaque. Even people like me who cover it regularly, I don't really know when things are coming or going from services until it actually happens. So unfortunately, it's, I guess the maybe the light on the horizon is that Disney has an underlying, for example, Disney has an underlying strategy that it wants its service to be the place where you can presume that you'll be able to get pretty much everything Disney right there. Even with trying to reach that kind of golden ideal, it's still going to fall short. For example, part of the pre-existing Netflix deal that has been funneling all those Disney movies to Netflix for these last 3 years, that deal had a farther out window wherein in, I think, 2026, 5 years, 6 years after Disney Plus has launched, there's going to be a period of time where some of these blockbuster Disney movies leave Disney Plus and go back to Netflix temporarily. So it's really, I wish I could tell you that it's going to get better, and maybe it will, but right now it seems like it's going to continue to be really confusing for the time being. And it's because programmers make so much money licensing their content to streaming services. It was a really big stream of revenue for a long time, and it's only now that they're starting to try to pull themselves out of these deals and this system of making money so that they can have full ownership of what they've created.
Joan, as we wrap up, what's the next piece of the puzzle you're watching for in the streaming world?
Yeah, well, we've got a little bit of a break. We had Apple TV Plus launch at the beginning of the month and then Disney Plus right after that. We've got a little bit of a break, but then next spring there's going to be this flood of other services. Not only is HBO Max going to be launching in May, but there is a similar streaming service from NBC Universal called Peacock that's going to be launching a little bit before that. And then there's this outlier called Quibi, which is bankrolled by all the major studios. It's being run by Disney's former head executive, Jeffrey Katzenberg. And it's spending lots of money to get big names like Guillermo del Toro and Steven Spielberg and all these other high-end film creators to make mobile-only short-form content. It's going to be very interesting to see exactly the reaction to that. But that's going to be the next wave when your streaming options are going to get even more complicated.
Joan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Joan E. Solzman with CNET looking at the latest in the streaming world. Public testimony is wrapping up for the week in the House Intelligence Committee's impeachment inquiry of President Trump. Two more witnesses were called today, including Ukraine Embassy political counselor David Holmes and the White House's former advisor on Russia, Fiona Hill. In her opening remarks, Hill went after Republicans who say claims that Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election have been overstated.
Based on questions and statements I've heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016.
Nine witnesses testified this week in the hearings. Barbara McQuaid is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School and former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barb, thanks for joining us again today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
A lot of twists and turns over the week, but big picture, what have you taken away from what we've seen in these public hearings?
I think it has come into focus that there was absolutely a quid pro quo here, whatever you want to call it. There was an effort to negotiate from Ukraine an agreement to investigate or at least publicly announce that they were investigating Joe Biden and the 2016 presidential election in exchange for military aid and a White House meeting. Whether you want to call it quid pro quo, whether you want to call it something else, It is apparent that that's what's going on. That's what Rudy Giuliani was negotiating, and that's what President Trump wanted. That's why the military aid was held up. And so I think the question now is, acknowledging those facts, what is the proper remedy, if any, that should go forward? I think that when members of Congress persist in trying to discredit these witnesses who are neutral public servants, they really only make the case worse for President Trump, because it suggests that if you believe them, what he did must be so bad that you must impeach.
I want to give a listen to a couple different parts of Gordon Sondland's testimony, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, very much at the center of the whole story. Here, and getting to this quid pro quo element, here's a clip from Sondland's opening statement.
I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
Okay, a big moment there. But Sondland later described a phone call he had with President Trump in which the president said he didn't want a quid pro quo. Here's a listen to that.
But I believe I just asked him an open-ended question, Mr. Chairman. What do you want from Ukraine? I keep hearing all these different ideas and theories and this and that. What do you want? And it was a very short, abrupt conversation. He was not in a good mood, and he just said, I want nothing. I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky to do the right thing, something to that effect.
Okay. Now, a lot of people focus on the first one there, saying, yes, he's saying there's a quid pro quo. The president and his supporters saying, wait a minute, there's Sondland saying the president said, no, I don't want that. How do you sort that out?
Well, I think you have to look at all of the evidence, not just the testimony of Gordon Sondland, but of all of the evidence, including President Trump's own phone call with President Zelensky of Ukraine, in which he says, upon being asked about the military aid, he says, I need you to do me a favor, though, and then proceeds to ask about the investigations. I think that piece of it. I think the other evidence about what Rudy Giuliani was doing, I think you have to look at. I also think you have to look at the timing of that September 9th phone call when President Trump says, no quid pro quo. It's a really interesting conversation. This conversation comes the day after the whistleblower complaint is filed. It also comes when Bill Taylor has text messaged Gordon Sondland to say, are you telling me that we are conditioning military aid on a political campaign? It is after that when Sondland says, what do you want me to say to these people? That President Trump says no quid pro quo. He offers it unsolicited. When you say, what do you want me to tell Ukraine? To say no quid pro quo sounds like he's playing defense to me. And so among the things you have to assess about that is, what was the motivation of the speaker? And at that point, I think he was playing defense and concerned that Bill Taylor was about to blow the whistle along with this whistleblower.
Talking to Barbara McQuaid from the University of Michigan Law School, looking at the latest in impeachment hearings. And we played that bit from Fiona Hill, former advisor, White House advisor on Russia, talking about really one of the two investigations that the president talked about in that phone call semi-transcript. A lot of people, we focused a lot on the Burisma and Joe Biden side of that, but also looking back at the 2016 election and the claim that there was a lot of Ukrainian meddling in the United States election, not so much Russian meddling, and Fiona Hill very much attacking that idea. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I thought that was one of the more powerful moments of the whole 2 weeks, when she said, essentially, there are people in this room who believe that it was Ukraine and not Russia that interfered with our election. That's a false narrative. That's disinformation. When you say those things, you make our country less safe. And I thought hearing that from someone like Fiona Hill, who is a neutral career professional, saying that was an incredibly powerful moment. It's not partisan politics. These are facts. And she is someone who cares deeply about our country's national security and foreign policy. For her to say that was very powerful. It struck me as a very stark contrast to the testimony of Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller was also a neutral witness, but I thought that he was neutral to a fault, and in places where he could have said things in a very powerful way, similar to what Fiona Hill did today, he worked very hard to not read the report, to defer to members of Congress, to refer to the written record, and I think in that way missed an opportunity to provide compelling information that caught the attention of the American public.
Want to listen to Devin Nunes, the top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee. In his opening remarks today, he said foreign aid gets withheld temporarily for a variety of reasons and made the case that the president hadn't done anything wrong. Here's a listen.
The Democrats have tried to solve this dilemma with a simple slogan. He got caught. President Trump, we are to believe, was just about to do something wrong, and getting caught was the only reason he backed down from whatever nefarious thought crime. The Democrats are accusing him of almost committing. I once again urge Americans to continue to consider the credibility of the Democrats on this committee who are now hurling these charges. For the last 3 years, it's not President Trump who got caught. It's the Democrats who got caught.
And that fits in with what some other Republicans have been saying on the committees, saying it, eventually the aid to Ukraine was released. There was no announcement of investigation from Ukrainian leaders. No harm, no foul, in effect, Barb.
Yeah, that's just utter nonsense. I can remember a time when the Republican Party cared about the rule of law and law enforcement and the law. Bribery is defined as demanding a thing of value in exchange for the performance of an official act. The crime is complete upon the demand. When President Trump said in that phone call on July 25th, "I want you to do us a favor," though, he made a demand, and the crime was done then. It didn't require the withholding of the aid. It didn't require the agreement or the announcement of investigations. The crime was committed the moment he made the demand. And the reason for that is when he makes a demand like that, he harms our national security. He withheld the aid that was needed for Ukraine to protect our national security, in addition to the national security of Ukraine, from Russian aggression. He also harmed our credibility around the world with our allies by failing to fulfill a promise to turn over aid unless they agreed to play ball with us. And he also harmed the integrity of the United States as a crusader against corruption by engaging in corrupt activity himself. So the crime is not a thought crime. The crime was committed when he demanded. That's the actus reus of bribery, and he did it. It constitutes a completed crime.
As you mentioned, the question, if people agree with that argument, is does it rise to an impeachable offense? And things like high crimes and misdemeanors is in the eye of the beholder in some cases. What does it take then to translate this series of actions to does it rise to the level of impeachment?
Absolutely. And I'm frustrated that the Republicans have dragged 2 weeks of testimony, dragged us through 2 weeks of testimony to get to the point where we now finally understand what the facts are. Because the real debate that we should be having is this an impeachable offense? And I think reasonable minds can disagree about that. Now, I could make an argument why it's a very serious crime or misdemeanor, bribery, as I've just articulated, the harm that the United States suffered. But I think someone could also make the other argument that perhaps there's other reasons, harm to the country, that perhaps we don't want to go down that road. You know, when a prosecutor decides whether to file charges, the first question that's asked is, was a crime committed? And that's only the first step. And here, I think the answer is quite clearly yes. But there's a second part of that inquiry. A prosecutor says, is there a substantial federal interest that can be advanced by filing criminal charges? And similarly, with impeachment, I think the question needs to be asked is it in the best interest of the country to file articles of impeachment? On the one hand, a reason to say yes is that the harm that has been suffered by the country, and if you don't, you risk setting a standard for every president that comes forward from this point on to be able to say, well, Trump got away with it. I shouldn't be held to a higher standard than he is. On the other hand, you could look at the collateral consequences of an impeachment. There is the time and the resources that it will expend from Congress on things they're not going to get to, like health care and gun control and other things that might be important to constituents. There are other collateral consequences, the harm that this might have with our allies around the world or our reputation around the world. Those are the serious things that members of Congress should be considering on the impeachment question, not whether there was or wasn't a quid pro quo. It quite obviously was, and I wish they would stop having petty arguments that it didn't.
We're talking about what happened this week during the Trump impeachment inquiry hearings with Barbara McQuaid, law professor at the University of Michigan, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your takeaways from the different testimonies this week? Who stood out to you if you've been watching or listening? Do you think the House votes to impeach President Trump? If they do that, should the Senate convict or not? Should they proceed with removing him from office or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with University of Michigan law professor and former U.S. attorney Barbara McQuaid, looking at the latest, the Trump impeachment inquiry hearings. You can join in with your thoughts and reactions at 800-642-1234. We'll go right to your calls now. Sid is with us in Milwaukee. Sid, hi.
Hey, so I just have two things to say. One is, you know, regardless of whatever these proceedings yearn, it's going to be an outcome of, you know, the Senate's not going to impeach him. So that's one thing. It is clearly a waste of time. But in addition, like, I don't know, it seems like the left clearly thinks that they solely understand morality, and they call, you know, doesn't seem right that how stern they are in their notion of morality and like just cockiness about it. I don't know.
Sid, thanks for the call. His first point there, Barbara, what's the point if almost certainly the Senate, Republican-dominated Senate, won't remove the president from office?
Yeah, I think there's a political point to be made there and a legal point to be made there. So politically, I think he's right. If the Senate members are not going to vote by 2/3, which is a, you know, supermajority to convict, is there political damage that is done to the Democratic Party? Does it have consequences for the election? Is it not only a waste of time, but counterproductive politically? And I think that's a calculus that members of both parties have to keep in mind, how it affects them politically. But I would hope that members of Congress have a higher duty to think about what is their duty as a check and balance in their oversight role of the presidency. If every time they say, well, he's not going to be removed from office anyway, so what's the point? How much more egregious does the behavior allow to happen if we allow there to be no consequence for misconduct? One of the reasons that we charge people with crimes under the law is for deterrence. And so I think that President Trump cares very much about his place in history. And I think a decision to impeach him, even if it ultimately results in no removal from office, does have some consequence because it sends a message that this behavior is not acceptable. And that if future presidents try to solicit foreign interference in our elections, it can be held up as a moment in history when Congress said this is unacceptable.
Sid, thanks for your call. We'll go to Marcus now in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Yes, thank you. Two quick points on the question for Professor McQuaid. Number one, in my opinion, the Democrats get absolutely no credit for any kind of righteousness in this. These are basically procedural crimes against the Congress, and they overlooked Trump's war crimes, fomenting domestic violence, his emoluments crimes, children in concentration camps. That doesn't affect anybody. But number two is right-wing radio, which is mostly owned by CBS, 85% of AM radio is owned by CBS, is re-spinning these hearings 24 hours a day, using every false argument in the book, Limbaugh, Levin, Hannity, pounding away, begging the question, non sequitur, after red herring.
Gotcha. Marcus, I want to jump in. And Barbara, we in many ways have a couple different realities going on depending on which part of the media landscape we focus on.
Yeah, I suppose. You know, I think we ought to have a yearning for the facts. And one of the things that I think is useful about the public hearings is we get to see them unfiltered. Certainly there is spin that occurs after the hearings occur. But while they're going on, the public gets to see for themselves what these public servants have to say. And, you know, we saw people like Fiona Hill and David Holmes today. These are people who have served in multiple administrations. They're not political actors. I think one of the real harms of the current age and the polarization of our media and our social media is there's this assumption, I think, by the public that the whole world divides into red and blue camps. And that's just not the case. So many people in public service have served in multiple administrations and are trying to present the facts. So regardless of whether this hurts the Democrats or helps the Democrats, or I think they don't care. I think what they say is this is harmful to our national security. These facts should be out there so that we can make a thoughtful decision about whether this is the way we want to conduct our government.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Barbara McQuaid from the University of Michigan Law School, looking at the latest in impeachment inquiry hearings. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Barron. Michael, hi.
Hi. I read somewhere that the Senate sometimes does, I believe they're called secret votes or anonymous votes. I'm wondering why the Senate does not opt to use that option.
Michael, thanks for the call. I don't know if Senate procedure is up your alley. Barb, do you know how that might work if a secret ballot, anonymous ballot, might work for an impeachment vote?
I don't, and it's a fascinating question because I have heard reports said that if it were secret, that there are a number of Republicans who would vote to convict President Trump, but that they don't dare because of the political ramifications. I don't know if that's true or not, but a secret ballot would help solve that problem. I don't know if they can or can't. One of the interesting things is that the Constitution is very quiet on the matter of impeachment. It just says that the House has the sole power of impeachment, and it says that the Senate shall be the trier of fact and will decide whether to remove the president from office. It doesn't really give any details about how they are to go about their work, and so they are permitted to create their own rules about how they're going to conduct things. On the one hand, I could see an argument that it should be public, it should be transparent, everyone should know how people came out. On the other hand, the way people vote in elections, the way jurors vote, is all secret and in a black box. And so I think you could make compelling arguments on both sides of that question, and I think it's a fascinating idea.
Let's bring on one more caller. Gene is with us in Richland County. Gene, hi.
Howdy. I have a two-part question, I guess, and I was listening to people talking before me. It was kind of already hit on the part where the Democrats, they think that they have this idea of what's right and wrong, and it's often always skewed, and they often jump the gun, as they always do. And you can often see them where they'll sit there and make this big mountain of evidence, and it turns out like the Steele dossier and things of such. And then the double standard that your guest is talking about, you know, how Trump's this, Trump that. But what about the double standard where often our country does withhold aid to before they get an understanding of what's going to happen when it's given?
Gene, thanks for that call. Let's tackle that second point in our little bit of time left, Barb. This is we do put conditions on our aid to other countries. This is just that, Gene's saying.
We do all the time, but the difference is that conditions are put on aid when they are in the best interest of our country. Those are perfectly legitimate. If we were to withhold aid and say, before we give you this aid, we want to make sure that you have a good anti-corruption program. We want to make sure that you're doing these things so that the money doesn't get squandered and spent in inappropriate ways. Perfectly appropriate, and that what we should be doing as good stewards of our taxpayer dollars. That's not what President Trump is accused of doing here. President Trump is accused here of withholding the aid for his personal political agenda. The only thing he wanted, according to Gordon Sondland, was an announcement that there was an investigation into Joe Biden and into the 2016 election interference. He didn't even want the investigations to occur. In fact, he just wanted an announcement because an announcement would allow him to have a talking point to smear his political opponents. That is a very different thing from acting in the best interest of the nation in spending taxpayer dollars and acting in the best political interest of the individual. In this way, President Trump has put his personal interests above the interests of his country, and I submit is an abuse of power for which impeachment is appropriate.
Gene, thanks for the call, and Barb, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks very much for having me.
That's Barbara McQuaid, professor at the University of Michigan Law School, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She joined us for a look at the latest in impeachment inquiry hearings. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. You can help. We want advice for people hosting their first ever Thanksgiving dinner. Tell us what works for you, what's gone wrong, and how you manage the big meal. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.